Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Radio Show. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Oh, yes. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. Folks, you are here on an amazing, amazing day. You don't even realize it yet. You don't even realize what a great show this is going to be. But joining me today for the entire broadcast, I'm so excited about this, Dr. Vladimir Maletic. And Dr. Maletic is truly one of the nation's leading voices, top researchers when it comes to the biology of depression and the neurobiology of mood. He hails from the University of South Carolina, and he's going to talk to us today about the very latest research that you need to know on the biology of depression, about why we get depressed or anxious. But we need to know the latest science, the latest nutritional information, the role of inflammation. We're going to be talking about fish oils and vitamin D, and also a form of the B vitamin folic acid that you might not even know about. It's got antidepressant properties, and did you know it's been approved for the treatment of depression? So we've got ourselves a full show, a jam-packed podcast, so let's not waste any more time. Let's begin. Okay, now, as I had said at the start of the show, I am truly honored to have Dr. Vladimir Maletic on the Healthy Mind Podcast today. And really, as it goes in terms of people we get excited about, psychiatrists get excited about, rock stars within psychiatry, if I can say, Dr. Maletic, I consider one of them. He is, without a doubt, one of the leading thought leaders and researchers in the field of psychiatry today. In fact, I had attended one of his lectures a few years ago, and I have to tell you, I was really blown away by his understanding of really the biology of depression, the neurobiology of depression. He has really been a force within psychiatry on the research end and really understanding depression as it is a biological issue and really what is going on in our brains, what is happening, and how do we understand depression as best as we can, both with many of the common theories that we understand with serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, and what are some of the new theories that are out there with inflammation, and what we want to talk especially here today with Dr. Maletic about the role of some of the nutritional issues, particularly with folic acid or L-methylfolate. But Dr. Maletic is a clinical professor of neuropsychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia, and he's also a consulting associate in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Duke University as well. Dr. Maletic is a member of several professional organizations, including the Southern Psychiatric Association and the American College of Psychiatrists. Dr. Maletic is a prolific author and researcher. He has published numerous articles in various journals throughout his career. He is really an amazing speaker as well, speaking nationally and really throughout the world at international meetings and international congresses. His specific areas of interest include the neurobiology of mood disorders, chronic pain, anxiety disorders, ADHD, and the regulation of sleep and wakefulness. Ladies and gentlemen, he truly is a leading voice in psychiatry today. Dr. Maletic, thank you so much. It's a privilege for me to have you on the Healthy Mind podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's indeed a privilege to be part of this program. I really look forward to our conversation.
No, really, the pleasure is all mine. I'm really looking forward to this discussion as well. I guess I wanted to maybe at first just get a sense for our audience in terms of maybe your story, how you came to all of this and what your motivations have been within psychiatry and how it's led you to this point in your career.
Well, it's a great question, and I wish it was a more straightforward path. But what has probably brought me into this line of research is wanting to address some of the uncertainties in psychiatry, especially pertaining to the relationship between diagnosis and treatment. Unfortunately, unlike other medical specialties where diagnosis is closely linked with certain kind of pathophysiology, so the underpinning of the disease, and that is something that informs us then what is the best path to pursue in treatment. In psychiatry, it is not nearly as straightforward. And in order to have more successful treatments, I believe we have to have a better understanding of a psychiatric condition. And therefore, my interest in this neurobiological underpinning and also the mind-body relationship in understanding psychiatric illness.
And when you had first entered, particularly into the research end of that, had you anticipated that you would follow down this road? Was it surprising in any way?
Yes, actually, that was something that I was interested in my early research. I had a little bit of a roundabout way of getting into psychiatry because I did basic science research first. So I started doing this work in the early 80s. So it's been a while. And at that time, what astounded me and frightened me is the magnitude of my ignorance about all the relevant issues. So fortunately, that fear was not sufficient to demotivate me. So, again, I've been working hard since then to try to, first of all, honestly, to bring some clarity in my way of thinking, because it would be hard for me to converse with colleagues such as yourself and with audiences without first having an understanding of what's really going on.
No, certainly. And as you say, from the 80s being there, were you doing the neurobiological research at that time in the 80s?
In some very primitive form, yes, that is what I was attempting to do.
Sure, because we look at that, and for those that may not be old enough to either remember or know, the game changed in psychiatry in the late 80s with Prozac. So this predates some of our earliest understanding of the most common medications that are prescribed today. I wanted to talk to you first off, maybe just on a personal level here, in your experience now doing this for 30 some years within the research, personally for you, what have you found to be not necessarily the most meaningful, but perhaps the most impactful or profound information or research that you have studied within emotional illness, depression, or whatever it may be within the mind and emotion? Does anything stick out for you in terms of something that just made you stop for a moment and realize?
It's most likely a realization that a major depressive disorder does not exist as a single entity. So we're probably dealing with a number of conditions that have similar enough manifestations. Their symptoms are much alike, and the composition of the symptoms is so much alike that we think about it as a single condition. At the biological level, whether we look at genes that may be involved, treatment response, neuroimaging studies, markers such as inflammatory chemicals in the bloodstream, they all point in the same direction. Some people will have it, other people will not. It's most likely not a single condition. Mm-hmm. So where does it leave us? If it's not a single condition, how can we best choose treatment for our patients? We have to come to a realization that right now, the symptoms are probabilistically related to condition. In other words, if we hypothesize about certain pathophysiological mechanisms being involved in generating these symptoms, it will be true for a number of depressed patients. But unfortunately, it's not going to be true for all of the depressed patients.
I see.
Where is this problematic? Because if we're trying to match up the treatment, so far, that is also probabilistic perspective. In other words, if we prescribe a given medication or even if we undertake psychotherapy with a given patient, there are always odds. Yes, it may work, and based on our clinical experience, we are a little bit better at making these choices and guessing, but ultimately it is a guesswork. So the area that really intrigues me is, can we find markers in terms of how patients present, in terms of genetics, in terms of chemical markers in their bloodstream or imaging that can give us more precise information? How do we approach the treatment so it is more effective for that particular patient?
So almost a personalized treatment, if you will, under a general kind of rubric of understanding how depression may work.
Exactly. That would be the final goal. That again, I don't think that we will, in foreseeable future, reach that degree of precision, but at least striving towards the goal with several marker, we can increase the odds of success from the current 40%, meaning 60% of the depressed people that we currently treat will not achieve remission, will not attain sense of health and wellness. So we would like to reverse those odds so that at least maybe 75 to 80% of the patients will benefit from our treatment, again, that is now guided by markers that provide better predictive value.
Sure. Wow. And it's in considering the biological part of this, what I was struck with, and Dr. Maletic was in town last year and spoke literally to a standing room only crowd of physicians and other medical professionals, if that'll give you an idea of how highly regarded he is. I think what struck me in that discussion where you were talking about in the topic I want to cover here in a bit on the role of folic acid, L-methylfolate in depression, was just that idea of depression, that we need to start looking at it not as a single entity, but as an umbrella of entities. And I guess my question to you then is, given what we have at this point, the typical treatments that we look at, both pharmacological and as well as therapy and other mind-body interventions, are you surprised that we can improve the quality of life for as many people as we do, given maybe some of our primitive tools, if that's fair to say?
Very pleasantly surprised. And you mentioned potential usage of L-methylfolate. So this is a form of vitamin B. And the intriguing question is, yes, it can help some patients who have depression. It can assist psychotherapy and other medications that are being utilized. For many patients, there will be no noticeable difference. Is there a way that we can select who may benefit from L-methylfolate from this adjunct form of vitamin B? It is also marketed as Deplin, versus the patients who are unlikely to have the benefit.
Yes, and I really want to hear your thoughts on this particular subject. But first, for those who may be hearing this for the first time, what we're talking about here is a form of folic acid, an absorbable form of folic acid, kind of already broken down form that is absorbed into the body. And as it turns out, this particular form has antidepressant properties. Can you tell us a little bit about the role maybe of folic acid, I guess, in general, but L-methylfolate in specific on how it affects depression, our mood, and what its role may be in all of this?
Yes. There is an enzyme, and for the sake of our discussion, the detail is not really as important. It is something that is called tetrahydrobiopterin, again, or BH4 for short. Mm-hmm. And this is an enzyme that is crucial in synthesis of serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, even melatonin, and neurotransmitters which have in the past been linked with pathophysiology of depression. So again, functioning of these neurotransmitters and modulators is key to having appropriate stress response and for appropriate regulation of mood. It is believed that in people who are depressed, there is a change, an alteration in the function of these signaling chemicals, and that it contributes to the disorder itself, but it can also be utilized. We can manipulate these neurotransmitters with our medications and restore some balance. And it's really interesting because this is an example where understanding the nature of illness can actually help us choose the appropriate treatment. Well, this chemical, or BH4, if the person has heightened stress or inflammation, all of the sudden is taken on a chemical sidetrack and becomes unavailable for the synthesis of these key neurotransmitters. So the question is, if this chemical is relatively permanently taken in the wrong direction, can something be done to restore it? Because by restoring it, we will also restore the neurotransmitter function. And research has established that L-methylfolate, or again, as I mentioned, commercially it is also known as Deplin, can provide an alternative synthetic route whereby BH4 or tetrahydrobiopterin is regenerated from another chemical that is available, and it is called BH2 or dehydrobiopterin. So this form of vitamin B helps in these critical situations when there is heightened stress or when there is heightened inflammation, helps her body restore this chemical BH4, which is so necessary for the successful regeneration of the neurotransmitters and in order for antidepressants to work properly. So again, it is one of those examples where understanding pathophysiology has led to research that has helped us identify patients who are more likely to benefit from this particular intervention.
I see. So just in, so I understand that fully, a normal stress response is going to cause these changes normally in our body, say inflammation and the like, will affect the ability of the body because of shared pathways to naturally, on its own, mount a decent antidepressant response when you need it because of decreased amounts of serotonin and the like that are created. And looking at it with, say, L-methylfolate or that mechanism of action, it helps to rejuvenate the particular chemicals or enzymes that are needed to have that process be optimal. Is that a fair way of saying it?
That is very, very correct way of saying it. So you're absolutely right. Stress or inflammation depletes that critical enzyme. Without it, our bodies are not able to synthesize serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, melatonin in appropriate way. Antidepressants don't work as well. And unfortunately, many of the patients who are in this predicament remain depressed.
I see. Yes, and we've talked about that throughout the history of this podcast with the role of inflammation. I know I talk about it with my patients regularly, that when the body is mounting an inflammatory response, the same building blocks that are needed to mount a response against inflammation are still the same chemical building blocks that are also needed to make our mood chemicals. So this is why we're seeing this relationship between inflammation and depression, and why we may see increased amount of depression in people who have inflammatory conditions or conditions that produce a lot of inflammation. But I wanted to talk with you a little bit. It's folate, L-methylfolate, and folic acid is a naturally occurring vitamin. Why not increase the diet of leafy green vegetables or even folic acid itself, supplement with folic acid? Why won't that be sufficient enough for mood?
And that is a great question. And I would say in majority of individuals, that would be true. Just having good, healthy diet or taking folic acid via the vitamins that are readily available on the drugstore shelves, that will be sufficient. Here's where we come to another layer. Either folic acid or dehydrofolate, which is the vitamin that we see that is present in foods, in green leafy vegetables you mentioned, they cannot readily get into the brain. In order to enter the brain via a five-step process, These dietary folates and folates that are available in multivitamins need to be converted into L-methylfolate. And only L-methylfolate is capable of crossing blood-brain barrier and getting to the brain, and that's actually where we need it.
I see.
The unfortunate part is that about one in six people will genetically have a lower activity of the enzyme that participates in this conversion. Therefore, even if they have appropriate diet and they take their vitamins regularly, again, due to their genetic makeup, they will not be able to take advantage of proper nutrition and generate this L-methylfolate, and therefore brain and neurotransmitter synthesis will continue to suffer in spite of all the appropriate efforts.
I see. One way, and I hope that this is fair in the way that I relate it to patients with an analogy, is if, say, they're lactose intolerant and they take in milk and dairy, they're not able to convert down to the type of sugar that their body can absorb, and there are a lot of symptoms that occur. And it seems like what is happening there in that process is you can take in as much folic acid as you want, either by supplements or leafy green vegetables, but if you don't have the proper enzymes to break that down, doesn't matter how much is there, it can't get through the door into the blood-brain barrier and then help in the way that it does with depression.
That is absolutely correct. And so that would be the second marker. The first would be looking at the markers of inflammation, and every lab can do an analysis and look for you're clearly very familiar with this compound. It's something that it's called C-reactive protein. Mm-hmm. So it is a very reliable indicator of inflammation. So if one gets high sensitivity CRP, and we usually look at the values that are higher than 3, that would indicate that the person has higher level of inflammation. But, is there something that we can readily observe just with naked eye without doing any lab values that would indicate that the person is at higher risk? And unfortunately, that is obesity.
I see.
So individuals who have a body mass index are at the risk of having a whole host of inflammation-related conditions, primarily because adipose tissue, fat tissue, is a huge reservoir of inflammatory cells and inflammatory chemicals. And therefore, this is something that we can observe in our patients. And if we calculate BMI, and you know how simple it is, we can look at who these at-risk patients are and patients that might require an adjunct of L-methylfolate, especially so if they have that deficient enzyme due to their genetic makeup.
I see. So in understanding that obesity or the more weight that we carry around, in a rough way of understanding that, just the more weight we have, the greater the inflammation load on the body. And then that really detracts from the body being able to have normal function as it relates to mood.
You're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, a German group around Dr. Kloiber and colleagues have actually done studies and have found that the higher the body mass index, so the more heavy the person is beyond certain point, the less likely they are to favorably respond to antidepressants. And indeed, being overweight and obese is also a prognostic factor for a number of chronic pain disorders, including fibromyalgia. So individuals who have higher body mass index are more likely to have pain. Unfortunately, they're also more likely to have cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease, most likely, at least in part, to elevation of inflammatory cytokines. They're more likely, there are some studies, if they have higher obesity and higher inflammation, to develop depression later on in their life. So it is a risk factor for a host of both medical and psychiatric illnesses.
Yeah, and an easier way for people to understand the mind-body connection as it relates to depression, emotional illness, I think, and I understand in terms of feeling some sense of stigma or concern about depression just on its own, how much of that is really biological or not. But as the data comes out more and more, and this is what I really want everyone here to understand, as I've talked about and I will continue to talk about on The Healthy Mind, what happens to our body, particularly as it relates with inflammation and, as Dr. Maltek says, with obesity, is going to have a ripple effect into our mood, and that happens through a biological process, a physical process. So as we talk about the need for treating depression, and I'm not talking about just medications. In fact, those of you who have been listening regularly to The Healthy Mind know that medications are not a focus of this podcast. But having said that, we need to look at the entirety of this mind-body connection, including the role of physical illness on depression and also the role of depression on physical illness. And it's bidirectional, and we're starting to learn more and more about what really is a true mind-body connection here.
You are absolutely right, and I think it's good that we don't leave our listeners with the impression that medications are the only solution. Some very interesting research was actually done in your backyard by Ohio State researchers, and what they have noted is that if one has bad marriages or bad relationships, that increases inflammation. Exercise is a very good way of decreasing inflammation, and I'm talking about regular exercise. Also, if one utilizes so-called anti-inflammatory diet, and this is a modification of Mediterranean diet, so a lot of raw vegetables and fruits and nuts, maybe lean meats, a cuisine based on olive oil, that also is anti-inflammatory. So some of the interventions that can benefit our mood and decrease inflammation are as simple as exercising regularly, cultivating good relationships, and eating healthy. Those are all very, very meaningful interventions. It doesn't just boil down to medications.
Of course, and I think that that's really important for everyone to realize. We've talked about that on The Healthy Mind. I'll post on the show notes some links to some of the articles that we've talked about, including the Ohio State research piece that we've, I believe, talked about on an earlier program, and also about a year ago, I remember seeing, I think, gosh, I can't remember it completely, but I believe it was out of the University of Grenada that looked at the role of fast foods and our mood, and it was exactly this particular issue that fast foods with their high fat, high calorie content increase inflammation. And in that, if we increase inflammation, it doesn't mean that if you have inflammation, you're going to be depressed, period. But that in understanding depression, we have to see that it's much more complex than just a chemical imbalance per se. And it echoes. This is why exercise, this is why diet, what we watch, what we eat, watching the stress in our lives really improves our mood. And we're only now beginning to understand how biologically this is happening.
And it's very important what you're mentioning, and that is that what happens in our body to a significant degree impacts on mood. There have been a couple of studies that have actually been done with healthy volunteers, and one would use a type of vaccine to instigate inflammation in the body. And what they would find is proportionate to increase of these inflammatory chemicals in the periphery, so in the body, there are changes in mood. So the higher the levels of these chemicals, the more despondent people become, the harder it is to concentrate. Even suicidal ideation emerges, and people tend to socially isolate. So these bodily processes, as you have mentioned, actually echo in mind and very much impact on how we feel.
I wanted to ask you just a kind of a speculation in terms of your thought, in terms of the actual depression that occurs, if we accept kind of serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, kind of what we've understood as perhaps what is happening here on some level, how much of the changes that are occurring do you believe are happening purely in the brain? Is there serotonin changes that might be happening in the gut or in the heart that are also adding to us being able to improve our mood or not?
Very much so. As a matter of fact, there is some interesting research looking into the function of serotonin signaling system in the periphery of the body. Dr. Raison and from University of Arizona and a group of German researchers are now looking at the impact of the change in bodily temperature on mood and coming up with some very interesting results in depressed patients. So again, it has been neglected up to now. These signaling systems that are present on both sides of the blood-brain barrier, so they're present in our bodies and in the brain, do communicate. I don't know how come, but several centuries ago, we have made this artificial division between the brain and the body. Unfortunately, the biology does not respect that boundary.
Yes.
Bodily interventions are quite impactful when it comes to our mood.
I agree. And to me, this is such an important point to make, because we want to invite everyone in, not just psychiatrists or physicians for that matter, into the discussion of emotions, depression, anxiety, and the like. Because if we understand that some of the things that intuitively, on a common sense level, like meditation or exercise, massage, acupuncture, can help our mood, it may be that we're now really starting to understand, maybe scratching the surface on how exactly, from a biological perspective, that is happening. And it's really exciting, I think, in the treatment of emotional issues, not only in terms of new treatments, say pharmacological treatments that come out for that medication treatments, but even the complementary and alternative types of treatments that are involved in all aspects of health, but especially here as it relates to mood. We are potentially getting to the point where we are going to start understanding why these types of treatments work. And I find that incredibly exciting. What more can you share with us?
There is some emerging science, and it's, again, very, very intriguing that even that clear division between neurotransmitter systems in the brain and immune system, which is typically associated with peripheral function, even that boundary is getting blurred. And that inflammatory chemicals, inflammatory cytokines, to a significant degree regulate the function of GABA and glutamate, two main neurotransmitters in the brain. GABA and glutamate combined account for about 95% of transmission in our brain. All the rest of the neurotransmitters, as numerous as they are, account only for about 5% of neurotransmission. So immune molecules from the periphery and immune molecules that get into the brain actually have a very significant impact on the function of these two main neurotransmitters. Vice versa is also true. GABA and glutamate, these main neurotransmitters, actually are very influential in regulating these inflammatory chemicals in the brain.
Okay.
To make things more interesting, what we call inflammatory chemicals, inflammatory cytokines in the body, actually in brain, are involved in regulation of neuroplasticity. So in order to remember things, we need these inflammatory molecules in our brain, but in appropriate quantities. It's not an issue of bad and good chemicals. It is all an issue of the right quantity.
Okay, and I think our Skype might have just cut out for just a second there. Did you say membrane neuroplasticity, just so our listeners could hear that?
No. What I was saying is that these inflammatory molecules are involved in memory.
Memory. Okay, I'm sorry. That just to cut out right at that moment, of course.
Without their presence, we would have very hard time remembering things. They're involved in memory and in neuroplasticity, so they assist brain to in rewiring itself in adaptive fashion. So if they're not present at all, or if their quantities are too low, that's actually not good, because we will be forgetful and our brain will not be able to adapt to the changes in the environment. So we need them there. We just need them in the right quantity. If they exceed that quantity, that is when we can transition into the disease state.
I see. I would imagine there are some implications there then on diet and more chronic memory loss, like dementia of Alzheimer's type or other forms of dementia. Are there some implications there with regards to that?
Absolutely, because, of course, this is not a very recent finding, but there is an intimate association between these inflammatory chemicals, inflammatory cytokines, and the progression of Alzheimer's. What's more intriguing, there was a study published early this winter, and they looked at usage of medications that block inflammation in the body for treatment-resistant depression.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is, if they block these inflammatory chemicals in the body, although the medication itself does not enter the brain at all, a substantial number of depressed people who have failed two antidepressant treatments will get better.
Even if it didn't hit the brain?
It never, the medication never reaches the brain. Now, the part that was really intriguing is when they looked at these individuals, what they concluded is if somebody did not have high level of inflammation in the body, this particular medicine that suppresses inflammation didn't help them at all. As a matter of fact, was mildly detrimental. On the other hand, depressed patients who had higher levels of inflammation in the body, who received this anti-inflammatory treatment, they're the ones who had the greatest benefit. Again, suggesting that we cannot look in absolute categories. Presence of a certain chemical is not bad. Access of a certain chemical in the body is to our detriment, and that is when we would need to pair it up with appropriate intervention.
I see. So I think in terms of the main point that I've gotten from the discussion thus far is that really understanding depression as more of an umbrella term, that for some people that may mean that inflammation is the issue, whether it's related to diet or not. For other individuals, it may be an issue of folic acid metabolism, where replenishing with L-methylfolate might be the answer. For others, it may be something that is of a deeper understanding or more basic in the form of just simply replenishing serotonin or norepinephrine. We're just not at a point where we can say there is one size that fits all by any means.
You're absolutely right. In a very similar fashion, experiencing early life adversity. So if one has been exposed to maltreatment or extreme poverty, or has lost a parent early in their life, these individuals are at a much higher risk of developing depression later on in their life. They're also at a higher risk of developing diabetes too, higher in their life, and a whole number of other inflammation-related conditions. The interesting part is that they are less likely to respond to antidepressants than other individuals. So what appears to be helpful in these individuals who have been traumatized early in their life is they have psychotherapy. Yes. So it's kind of intriguing that we think about anything that does not respond to antidepressant as treatment resistance. I think the more proper way to look at it would be it is resistance to antidepressants. Other treatment interventions such as psychotherapy actually may be quite beneficial to these individuals.
Well, that's very... That's very impressive to hear that, because that certainly brings then into maybe a better level of understanding, particularly for those individuals that may have a history of trauma earlier in their lives and may manifest some of their emotional symptoms as physical pain in fibromyalgia or some of the psychophysiologic disorders that I treat as well as other providers treat as well. So it's really fascinating to think how something that early in life can have such a profound impact later.
Yes, absolutely. There was a famous Dunedin study that was done in New Zealand. The interesting aspect of this study is that it went on for 37 years. And it is the events in the first 5 years of the person's life that to a significant degree determined their risk for cardiovascular disease, inflammation-related disease, but also depression later on in their life.
Wow, that's amazing. Almost a biological validation of Freud, as it were.
Absolutely.
That's pretty amazing. I wanted to get your thoughts on the role of, we talk about it a lot here, and a lot of emails come into me with regards to the role of fish oils. And I know you have talked about this before in your lectures in terms of why perhaps the fish oils themselves may have an antidepressant property to them. I think I kind of know the answer, but in terms of your thoughts as to why that might happen.
Well, there are probably multiple reasons why they may be beneficial. One of them is they help provide building blocks for nerve cell membranes. So that is clearly important. But the other aspect that is quite intriguing is that fish oils actually have an anti-inflammatory impact. So they can steer away metabolic pathway from synthesis of inflammatory chemicals. So if we have them in abundance, that can actually help with all inflammation-related processes, including depression.
I see. So you just lower all of inflammation, the part that is inflammation that affects our mood, that as well will help.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wonderful. You know, with the time that we have left, I just wanted to ask you in terms of your thoughts on the role of vitamin D, perhaps in depression at all. It is something that we talk about a lot. Dr. John Cannell of the Vitamin D Council has been on the program as well. I have a lot of respect for his work and everything that he's doing there. But your thoughts on the state of the science there and where are we, if there is any connection between
vitamin
D? Well,
yes, there actually has been quite a bit of research, and this is something that we do screen in our patients who have not responded well to other antidepressant treatments. Vitamin D has a major role in regulating calcium metabolism, not only in the periphery of the body, but in the brain. Appropriate calcium metabolism and exchange across the membrane is of crucial importance for the release of just the neurotransmitters that we have talked about. Okay. If there is inappropriate sequestration and inappropriate distribution of calcium inside the cells versus outside the cells in the brain, so it's an uphill battle to reestablish balance if there is not appropriate metabolism of calcium. And of course, without the appropriate amounts of vitamin D, calcium metabolism will be compromised.
And the important part here, maybe not everyone realizes, is that vitamin D levels, there's something that can be measured in our blood. And certainly if that's appropriate, obviously that's a discussion between you and your physician or medical health professional. But that is something, and I've shared with all of you here on the show how the vast majority, I'd say easily 90% of those blood values that I check are deficient in vitamin D. And we need to do a better job of awareness and advocacy for all aspects of treatment with it having to do with nutritional and physical and emotional. And that does include vitamin D as well.
You're absolutely right. And I think with the change of our lifestyle and spending much more time indoors and the change in our diet, that unfortunately becomes a greater risk of having hypovitaminosis of vitamin D.
Wow. I have to tell you, this has been an amazing conversation, just so much information. I can't thank you enough for being on the program with us, Dr. Maletic. I guess I'll close with just one final question, if you don't mind indulging me on this. You know, in the culture out there, and I understand that I'm not even trying to defend it in any way, but there is a fairly decent anti-psychiatry movement there with regards to the state of the science, how much we really do know and don't know about the biology of depression, if the biology of depression even exists. But your thoughts in how to address that or some thoughts that you can share with us in the state of the science, kind of in a general way, some of our blind spots or vulnerabilities and how to approach this in the future looking forward.
Well, it's a very good point, and I wish we could say that we are on par with other specialties in medicine. Unfortunately, we're not quite there. But on the other hand, it would be very unfair to dismiss a huge amount of work that has been done in order to better understand the neurobiological underpinning of major mood disorders. What makes things more challenging is, by far, brain is the most complex organ in the body. Unfortunately, psychiatric conditions, unlike, for example, strep throat, do not have a single entry point that will explain the origin of illness. They're multifactorial. And there are probably many more variations to psychiatric illness than to many of the medical illnesses. So we're dealing with much greater degree of complexity. Pieces are beginning to fall into place, and we're beginning to have a useful understanding of what is going on in the brain, useful in that it can predict the success of our treatment and can unfortunately also predict our failures in psychiatry. We are not quite ready for prime time. We're the rest to make diagnosis and treatment that is as precise as in some other medical specialties, but we're getting there. I think that within next decade, we'll be much closer to that goal.
And that's a wonderful thing to consider and to strive towards. I really agree with you. I think we are going to get there. You know, I try to talk about it. You know, let's continue to have that discussion. I think the last thing that anyone in psychiatry wants to do is be too defensive on the voices that legitimately say, how much do you really know? Because we make a choice whether or not we take that on and defend against it and say, wait a minute, I need to prove to you because I want to be legitimate, versus I hear you, I acknowledge our blind spots, but here's the meaningful data that we've brought to the biology of depression, and here's where we still have work to do, but that it isn't all explained by biology either. It's going to be a combination, and really for those who listen here, you know where I stand with that. For me and the treatment of depression and anxiety, the treatment from the medical end, the pharmaceutical end, the pharmacologic end, it's there to get the noise out of the way. The success, the movement that you move forward in your lives happens from your strength and the undying spirit that is there. And that's why I always say, never doubt how truly powerful you are. So we're going to continue the conversation. We're going to acknowledge when we don't know some things, but we're also going to advocate for the things that we do know, because it isn't just about the question of feeling better emotionally. There are meaningful risks to our body in a person who has anxiety and depression across 20 or 30 years of their life. And we're also, more importantly, trying to make sure that we treat the whole of the person emotionally and physically. So, you know, Dr. Maletic, I can't thank you enough in terms of individuals that I hold in high respect and could dream of having on my program. To have you on is just a high honor for me. And I thank you for taking the time to spend with us and my audience. And I hope that you'll join us again in the future to discuss more about it.
Gladly, and thank you very much on your kind invitation and allowing me to join you and your friends who are following this program. So again, thank you very much.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Maletic. I sincerely, sincerely appreciate it. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is just about going to do it for this week's broadcast of The Healthy Mind. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I hope you found the information from Dr. Maletic helpful and informative to you. He truly is one of the world leaders in psychiatry and psychiatry research. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. And any questions, comments, anything, I want to hear from you. Thank you for sending those emails along. You can reach me at Peter@thehealthymind.com. That's Peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.